I studied humility as a graduate student. That was my dissertation. I did a dissertation on St. Augustine's view of humility. And, I went to my dissertation director to start off, and I was like, I was interested. I've been in the Navy for a while. I'd done a lot of grad school, and I saw there was an intersection between philosophy and theology and leadership. And so I went to my director, and I was like, I want to write on love and leadership. And he was like, well, why don't you write about the history of the universe and the meaning of life at the same time? It's just kind of broad. It's like, okay. So he said, narrow it down. So I focused on humility. I wanted to take a Christological approach to humility. And one of the things, and you'll see this later in the slides, one of the things that I think is really important is St. Paul's famous hymn in the letter to the Philippians, 2:5-11, where he says, Christ did not see divinity as something to be grasped, but rather humbled himself. In the Greek, it's actually kenosis, kenotic. He emptied himself of his divinity, taking the form of a human person and the indignity of death on the cross. But because of that, he was exalted above every other name. So it's this interesting relationship between humiliation and exaltation that's kind of in that hymn. So I wanted to pursue that in St. I was Catholic, so I was like, well, who's a great thinker? St. Thomas Aquinas. And I went to St. Thomas, and he did not have a focus of humility on Christ, which I was very surprised about, because, well, I just was not very read and not very ignorant. And a lot of people that study St. Thomas would not be surprised about that at all, because St. Thomas, one of his big projects was to reconcile Aristotle's thought with the Christian tradition. And Aristotle was not big on humility, and so St. Thomas was trying to integrate Aristotle's thought with a very strong Christian tradition on humility. And so then I turned to Augustine, and so I did a lot of study on Augustine. He wrote a lot. He was a saint from the 4th century, and he wrote a lot on humility in a very beautiful way. And so I found my intellectual home with Augustine. So I get to the Naval, I finish my degree, I get back to the Naval Academy to teach, and so I want to come in there. It's kind of a hard position. I want to come in and brag about everything I know about humility, which that doesn't really work that well. So I came in, and then I'm in the Department of Leadership, and it was something I was interested in, but I hadn't been thinking about it yet too much. And almost immediately, one of the philosophers asked me the question, well, does a leader need to be proud or humble? And I was like, I don't know. I'm not sure. I'd have to think about that. And so I have been thinking about it, and I've done some digging, and it's interesting because it's kind of complicated. So I want to ask this question. Actually, we can go to the next slide. Can we say, are the great leaders, are they proud or humble? So we can look at some historical figures. Alexander the Great, and he's a historical figure that will actually tie some of our thinkers together. And so David Hume, actually, he had a quote about Alexander. David Hume, he's a contemporary of Adam Smith, he's from Scotland, a very influential guy in the 18th century, very much a critic of Christianity, although he kind of had to hide that because Christianity was so dominant at the time. But what he said about Alexander, he said, Alexander felt in himself such a dignity, and so he was a philosopher and he's also a historian, so he's coming at it from both angles. Alexander felt in himself such a dignity and right of empire that he could not believe it possible that anyone would refuse to obey him. Whether in Europe or in Asia, among Greeks or Persians, all was indifferent to him. Wherever he found men, he fancied he should find subjects. And then he goes on to talk about pride, and he says, whatever we admire under the character of greatness is either nothing but a steady and well-established pride and self-esteem, or partakers largely of those passions. Okay. So Hume, and we'll see he's a follower of Aristotle, is pretty high on pride. But then you have other models of leadership, like Gandhi. So Gandhi is obviously an influential leader, and he embraced poverty, relative poverty. In India, he made his own clothes, and he was willing to suffer the humiliation of going to jail to further his cause. So very different style than Alexander. So the question, I guess, goes in: what's going on here? What are the implications for leadership? So it turns out these are historical examples of this really big divide in history, the history of thought, between the value of this well-established self-esteem that David Hume's talking about, pride, and then focus on humility, or focus on pride as gravely evil. Okay, and so Aristotle and C.S. Lewis, we're going to take a look at some of their writings on these two topics, and they, on the surface, they couldn't seem more diametrically opposed. So, and they're both, it's not like there's just these two authors that, you know, happen to be opposed to one another. The reality is that they are very good representations of very long traditions. Is that, you know, Lewis is a representation of not only Christian tradition, but the Jewish tradition behind that. That Judaism, ancient Judaism, valued the ideal of humility. You see it in the book of Sirach, you see it in the Proverbs and the Psalms. You can see it, you know, I was just reading Genesis for the first time in a while. You can see it in the way, for example, Jacob conducted himself. And, you know, I'd never read it that closely before, but it's at points, Jacob's success was based on the fact that he was able to humble himself to Esau and other people that were much stronger than him, might kill him. But so you see there's a long tradition in Judaism which Christianity takes on and moves even further to say, one, that pride is horribly detrimental and that humility is a wonderful virtue. So then on the Aristotelian side, you have ancient authors and also very modern authors, not only like David Hume, but Karl Marx and also a guy named Friedrich Nietzsche, who are very much in Aristotle's camp, and say not only do they not like humility, they say pride is where it's at. If you want to be a great person, you must be proud. So there's a huge divide here between these two ideas. So what I want to do is examine that. So I'm going to start out with Aristotle, and then we'll move into a Christian view and see if we can, if they're mutually exclusive or if we can pull them together. And so there's the confusion. I guess I'm in a class or on a computer that would be here visually. Okay. So Aristotle, what he had to say about the pride. So the language is a problem here, but it can also be a help. So the Greek word that Aristotle is talking about is megalopsychos, megalopsychia. Oh, Matt, you're the language guy. You probably know more about it than me. But so that's the Greek word. Megalo is great. Psychia is soul or spirit, right? So greatness of soul. But that's translated into Latin as magnanimitas. Again, magna, great. Nimitas is off the pneuma for, again, soul or spirit or anima, I should say. But into English, it's translated magnanimity. But magnanimity, the English term, actually doesn't mean the same thing as megalopsychia or magnanimitas. The closest English cognate is pride. Okay. So Aristotle has a lot to say about it. Okay. The proud, and so actually two salient elements of the proud for Aristotle is that they are truly virtuous, and they are aware of that virtue. So that's the core of the idea. They recognize their virtues, their strengths, and they are aware of it. And so Aristotle's got this construct of what it means to be morally excellent. And moral excellence falls at a mean between extremes. So an easy example is the virtue of courage. So courage is more excellent, moral excellence. And it's a mean between cowardliness on one side and recklessness on the other side. So the courageous person is able to do the right thing in a situation of danger. They're not reckless, they're not cowardly. Okay, so it's the mean is the virtue. So with regard to magnanimity or pride, they fit that schema because they know how talented they are. So they're not vain, they don't overestimate themselves, and they don't have undue humility, which is actually a word that I can't say. Pusillanimous is undue humility. Okay, actually I said it okay there. So magnanimity is this mean between those things. Is that how it fits in? That's how it fits into Aristotle's definition of a virtue. And what's important is self-knowledge is important also, because that's kind of the link to humility, because humility and pride are both habits of mind that are concerned with our view of ourselves. Okay, so the proud person that recognizes their strengths is somebody that's looking at themselves. It's the humble person who's looking at themselves and maybe not seeing their strengths, so to speak. So that's the core of it. But Aristotle actually spends a lot of time on this idea of megalopsychos, the great soul person. And he gives a very thorough description. It's so thorough, he talks about the way they walk, the way they talk. It's hard for short people, no offense, I'm pretty short, to be great souled, but you know they can aspire to it, so you have to be kind of tall. So I think some of those things are culturally bound, obviously. But he has this whole list of stuff, and so he says, the proud person is good in every way. They truly are virtuous. They are concerned with honor. So the Greeks would say there are different types of goods. There's goods to the soul, there's goods to the body, and then there's external goods. External goods might be money, they might be fame, it might be material. material possessions, but the greatest of the external goods was honor, because honor is what we give to the gods. And so on, so the great soul person, the greatest people, were concerned with honor. That's what they, and so that's what they were pursuing. They weren't so concerned, they were more concerned with their virtue. It wasn't that they were just out there looking for honors, but honor is what drove the great soul person from Aristotle's perspective. So magnanimity was the honor management virtue for him. And that's something that St. Thomas Aquinas goes into. So so Aristotle says pride makes the other virtues greater. So the great person, the great soul person, they don't do a lot of things. They only sound kind of indolent and lazy. They hang around, they wait for the great things to come, and then they do great things. But in doing those great things, that draws on their strengths and makes them greater, because we undertake a great endeavor, you have to develop, you rely on your virtues and develop them further. So magnanimity is the crown of the virtues. It can't exist without the other virtues, but it also makes the other virtues better. Okay? They only do great deeds. And he says the magnanimous person, the person of pride, when they interact with others, they can handle themselves with the great of the world, but they're also unassuming among people of more average means too. So they're not totally obnoxious. But it's what's interesting, so these are kind of the nice aspects. Over to the right, there are some not so nice aspects about the proud person that he articulates. And to be honest, a lot of philosophers really criticize Aristotle. Some philosophers literally have written articles to say he must be joking because this stuff is so stupid, he couldn't possibly actually mean it. But I think it's fair to say that he does mean it. So he says that the great soul person, they give gifts, but they don't like receiving them. Which almost sounds Christian. But the motivation is not because they are generous. The motivation is that if you give to others, then you're superior to them. And if you receive from others, well, then you're inferior. And the great soul person does not want that. So that kind of empties the value of being a gift giver, when the only reason you give gifts is to make sure other people know that they're not as good as you. And that's basically what he's saying about the great soul person. They wish to be superior. They look down on others because the reality is they're better than others. They are great. They're truly virtuous. And they are also, they're open in love and hate, he says, because not to be open about your interior thoughts would be timid and servile, and so the great are not like that. So the magnanimous person is a person that goes around, looks down on you, and is very happy to tell you that he or she is looking down on you also. So it's not the most attractive picture necessarily. And then he finishes off with this idea of self-sufficient. And some philosophers have really criticized him for this idea of self-sufficiency. So he's a Scottish philosopher. He lives in America now. He's very elderly now, named Alasdair MacIntyre, maybe one of the most influential philosophers in the 20th century. And he's very focused on Aristotle and generally champions Aristotle, but he criticizes him on this point. He says self-sufficiency, one, is impossible. And so MacIntyre wrote a book called Dependent Rational Animals, which is another way of saying human beings, is that we are dependent, we're always dependent, and there's a continuum of dependency. We start out as babies as radically dependent, and oftentimes at the end of our lives, we're radically dependent. The reality is that we're always dependent. We become a little less dependent in the hail of our strength, so to speak, but even then, we're still very dependent on people. And so what MacIntyre would say, Aristotle probably didn't think that the magnanimous person really was completely self-sufficient, but he also says that if the goal is self-sufficiency, you're going to miss really important aspects of the moral life, that you're not going to recognize the gifts that other people provide to you, the support other people provide to you, and then you don't become a thankful person, you don't become a grateful person. And so these are the virtues. There are virtues of being dependent, and that's an important part of the moral life that really the Aristotelian tradition just frankly is blind to. So there's some criticism of Aristotle on the crown. Although, again, I think MacIntyre and St. Thomas would say, hey, the fact that someone recognizes their strengths actually is a virtue. So the way Aristotle lays out some of the implications might be problematic, but even Christian philosophers say, hey, there's something worth holding on to here. So if we go to the next slide. So this guy, David Hume, comes along, and he's a fan of Aristotle. I should have showed you the two quotes. And what's interesting, so David Hume focuses on Alexander the Great, and it's not a coincidence that Aristotle was the tutor of Alexander the Great. And so so Hume focuses on that in his lens as a historian and in his philosophical thought. And but he recognizes, he says, you know, if you're arrogant, that's obnoxious, and people aren't going to like you. And so if you're going to be great, you have to be have this very strong self-esteem. But how do you manage that when that turns a lot of people off? So this is what the conclusion comes to. Since arrogance is obnoxious, so be proud on the inside, but be modest on the outside. Okay, and so and what's interesting is that he's careful in his pick of the word modest, because he says you should not be humble. Like an interior humility, that is bad. That is, and so he's very much a critic of the Christian tradition of moral values, so to speak, the ideas of like penance and self-sacrifice and humility and suffering. It's like none of that makes any sense, and none of that is good. It doesn't make anybody happy. The moral life is about the pursuit of happiness, and all these Christian ideas just get people depressed. So he wants to move away from that. So humility is one of those things that you don't want to be humble on the inside. You're gonna be very unhappy. So so be proud on the inside and modest on the outside. Okay. So that's his resolution for kind of, you know, putting Aristotle a little bit in the box, shaving off some of the unattractive parts. So does it work? And I think I have another. If you can go to the next slide. So yeah, does Aristotle plus Hume equal great leadership? So this is I won't torture you with asking you the question and expecting a response. But that's what I do with my students. I say, well, what is this? Says yes, that's it. That's the answer. So, but what I want to do is bring in the Christian tradition, because I think it has something to offer, and that this is actually not a great recipe for leadership. So, and one thing I ask my students, and I can ask you too, is: have you ever encountered a leader that pretends that they care about you, but really care about them more? If you haven't, you will. Not that that has ever happened in the Navy. But it happens. And the thing is that you're not going to be loyal to that person. And when push comes to shove, you're going to be less likely to follow that person, because they don't care about you. They care about themselves, right? So so how do we get around this? So, all right, so let's go back to C.S. Lewis. So these bullets are taken from chapter 8 of C.S. Lewis's book, Mere Christianity. And so he has this chapter. And actually, it's actually primarily on pride, which he says is the great sin. So Aristotle says it's the greatest virtue. Lewis says it's the greatest sin. And so I want to get to the bottom where he says how bad pride is. But he has some ideas about humility too, because humility's got some baggage. So he says humble person isn't necessarily a lowly. So a humble person isn't necessarily a loser, which a lot of people say if you're humble, you must be a loser. You're a doormat that gets walked on. But the humble person is self-forgetful. And I think that's an interesting thought, which I'm going to come back to. He says, pleasure in being praised is a pride. It's okay to be proud of something. And he says, you know, and he actually uses, to be proud of your school, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, so to be proud to be a sooner, that's great. The problem comes when you start saying, I'm really cool because I'm a sooner, or I'm better than all those corn huskers because I'm a sooner, right? So, but it's not so much the joy of maybe receiving praise or being proud of your child. There's some profound goods in there. But when you start saying, well, look how great my child is. That must be, I'm an awesome parent, so much better than these other parents. That's where you may take some level of turn. And that's where you start going down this road of pride that can be very debilitating, really. So he talks about pride is the worst fault, so don't let it crowd out other faults. It's the vice that leads to every other vice. It's the source of all evil. It's competitive. And so, and this is where he's drawing on someone like St. Augustine, who talks about pride as constantly trying to be better than other people. And because of that, it creates enmity. And so the way Augustine talks about it, he says, pride is the mother of envy. That wherever you're dealing with proud people, you're dealing with people who are alienating everybody around them, so to speak. Because they're constantly competing against people, and they're constantly trying to be better than. And this is really interesting too. The proud cannot know God, because fundamentally, especially from a Christian perspective, the relationship between the believer and God is a relationship of humility. That to recognize the Christian God is to recognize a transcendent and exalted God, right? And that a God that we can't measure up to. And so a proud person either doesn't believe in God, or the God that they believe in is a fictional God. because it's not exalting God. And so so the proud person is spiritually debilitated because they're cut off from the source, the spiritual source of goodness, which is God. So this is from the Christian perspective, okay? So so why the difference? And can these two views be reconciled? So you know, it's interesting is that we're literally talking about pride on one hand, great, pride on the other hand. How do we get around this thing? Let's go next. So I think it is to a certain extent a problem of language. So these are the Latin terms, superbia and magnanimitas. So this is the translation of Aristotle's Greek term megalopsychos. So this is great souls. And so this is translated in English as magnanimity. Although I think the 21st century version of magnanimity is a little different than magnanimitas. Magnanimitas, megalopsychia, is this idea that Aristotle defined. It is a person recognizing their strengths, recognizing their virtues, and on the basis of that, they're able to do great things. So magnanimity in English right now is more a strong person that's able to forgive an enemy or something like that when you show magnanimity. So there's a bit of a difference. So magnanimitas is this ability to recognize your strengths, and so many people translate that into English as pride. Superbia, this is the Latin term for the sin of pride. So superbia is a self-love that displaces all other loves, up to and including love for God. So the sin of superbia is not the same thing as magnanimitas, but in English, it kind of is, because we've got pride in English is an ambiguous term. Right, so we are in some ways talking about two different things. We're talking on one hand self-love that crowds out all other loves, and the other we're talking about a recognition that we might actually have some talents. So there is difference. The problem with Aristotle, I think, is that there's a quick transition, which Lewis is recognizing, from recognizing your strengths to thinking you're awesome. That's our tendency. We recoil from self-criticism, we like self-praise, and so there's a very strong dynamic to go from magnanimity, in the classical sense, to arrogance and hubris. Okay, so how do we keep ourselves from doing that? That's excellent. So here we go. Finally, it's Mystic Institute. We're back to St. Thomas. Okay, and so what St. Thomas says is that this is what I wasn't interested in my grad studies, and now I came back when I was teaching. I said, wait a second, I need to go back to this guy, St. Thomas, because he has something to offer here. And so St. Thomas says, yes, magnanimity is truly a virtue. But he says there are four cardinal virtues in the Greek tradition, and Roman tradition, and Christian tradition: practical wisdom and prudence, courage, which is the ability to do something good in the face of danger, temperance, and that's temperance is a foreign concept. Our society, most people, most of my students, when I talk about temperance, they've never even heard of it, actually. So temperance is your ability to temper your desire for good things. And so it's an ability to hold back your desire. And then the last one is justice. So these are the four cardinal virtues, different than the theological virtues of faith, hope, and love. Four cardinal virtues are philosophical virtues that provide categories for all the other virtues. All the other virtues kind of fit in under these four categories, and because we can come up with many, many virtues. And so what St. Thomas says is, hey, these are two different virtues that good people need to have. They need to have magnanimity, and they need to have humility. And so magnanimity is under the umbrella of courage. It helps us do great things. It helps us take on great tasks because we have a confidence based on the talents that we have given to us. And what St. Thomas brings in that Aristotle lacked was a notion of God giving us gifts. So it's a recognition of the gifts that God has given us in an ability and even a responsibility to use those gifts to do greater things, to do good in the world, so to speak. So he says, yes, that it truly is a virtue. But also, there's this thing about humility. So humility, from St. Thomas's perspective, is the ability to hold yourself back. It's a tempering. You're holding yourself back from doing great things that you don't have the ability to do in the first place. So there's a wisdom to humility, recognizing that you don't have all the strengths necessary to do certain tasks, and humility holds you back from that. It tempers your desire for the goodness, so to speak. So these are two different forms of two of the cardinal virtues. Okay. So there. So this is my thought. So it's probably wrong, but I think there has to be a priority to humility over magnanimity. That magnanimity. So we have two virtues here. Magnanimity is the virtue of recognizing your talents. Humility is the virtue of recognizing your weaknesses. And the thing is that we like thinking well of ourselves, and we have a tendency towards magnanimity. We don't like thinking lowly of ourselves, and so we have a tendency to shy away from that. And so I think humility is the virtue that we have to work on, and it's crucial because magnanimity without humility, one, is self-deception, and two, merges into arrogance and hubris very quickly. And the reason I say it's self-deception is that if you're looking only at your strengths and not considering your weaknesses, well, you are not recognizing the fact that you're a human and that you have failings and you have weaknesses. And so to have magnanimity without humility is to have a false self-view. I think you can also make the other argument that to have humility without magnanimity, that's a bad thing too. Because, and again, this is a Christian context, to say, everything, we go back to Genesis on this, God's creation is good. He declared it good. We believe it to be good. So everything that we have that's given to us by God, these talents, they are good. And if we don't have an ability to recognize that because all we look at is our failings and our weaknesses, then we're doing something wrong there also. But I think we have a priority for humility because we're more likely to focus on what we do well rather than what we do poorly. Okay. So I want to give an example of how this works out in leadership. So my question is, should leaders be magnanimous or humble? Yes. The reality is that to be a great leader, you need to be both. And I would say, just to kind of cap that off, great leaders, I mean, in some ways, and now I'm going to reverse myself, magnanimity in that sense, I think, is in some ways fundamental to leadership, is that in order to have the native confidence to step out in front of a crowd and take on a great task that only a group of people can take on, you need some self-confidence and recognition of the strengths and the talents that you have. So it's very, I'm sure there are humble people that don't do that and still are able to lead somehow, but I think it's fundamental to leadership to have some kind of sense of your strengths in order to lead well. That being said, humility is this really interesting virtue that is kind of hard to define in a lot of ways, and it has so many good effects on leadership. It enables a leader not to get overconfident, not to take risks, unwarranted risks, be able to listen to other people, not think, it's my way or the highway type of stuff, be open to the ideas of others, especially in I have some leadership experience being in the Navy and being in the military, and one of the things that I've learned in those roles is my ideas, sometimes they're good, and a lot of times they're not that good. And a lot more times, especially when I'm working with a larger group, someone else has better ideas. And every time when I interact with those groups, even if I have an idea that's worthwhile, it gets much better as I try to articulate it to other people, and people refine it. And so that, that's one of the things that humility can help you with, is that you're open to the ideas of others, you can learn from others, and that is really powerful within an organization. So humility is this trait that is really powerful in terms of the efficacy of leadership. One other aspect of humility, so we talked about humility as an ability to recognize your weaknesses, and then it's a virtue that helps you to relate to other people. Again, in the opposite of the arrogant person who alienates people, humble people are actually attractive. People enjoy being around them. And it kind of goes back to Lewis's comment about the humble person isn't necessarily thinking poorly of themselves. Although I think there is a meaning of humility of loneliness, so you have to accept the fact that there's a negative aspect to humility, that there's a loneliness to humility. But the humble person is self-forgetful. And the humble person is looking towards others but not towards himself. So it's interesting. And so St. Augustine goes back to Genesis. And as he's thinking about pride, humility comes in. And he's, in some ways, he's really radical about this. When he talks about the revelation of Christianity, he says, the reason Christ came was to teach humility. Literally, he says that. That's why he came. That's the only reason he came. I don't know if I, I'm a fan, but I don't know if I can go that far. But the reason he says that is he says the sin, the ultimate sin, is pride. It's the self-love that pushes God out and makes us the center of the universe. So what's the antidote to that? That is humility. And so in that context, humility is not just a recognition of, you know, your lowliness or your weakness. Humility is really a form of love or a form of charity where you're not focused on yourself, you're not consumed with yourself, you're focused on other people, and you know, you're focused on your neighbor, and you're focused on God. And so there's an orientation of the humble person outward that is, you know, very different than the crowd person. So just to get some of the elements of humility, because it's really a rich concept. Okay, so we can go to the next slide. So, question, is Jesus humble, or we could say properly proud? And, you know, what's interesting is that the Jewish and the Christian tradition very much focus on the value of humility. And so as practicing Christians, we usually think of Jesus as humble. We can go to the next one, for good reason. And I can't remember, so you can tell I'm Catholic, because I can't remember all these So let me just look at my notes a little bit here. What's interesting is that these are all cherry picked. For every one of the verses I talk about here, you could probably find two more that talk about humility. So Philippians 2:5-11, Christ, you know, I've already mentioned that Christ did not think divinity was something to grasp, but humbled himself, emptied himself of divinity to become the form of humanity. Luke 2:12, that's the infancy narrative. So you know, the second person of the Holy Trinity comes in as a baby born in poverty, a very humble being. John 1:9-12, so this is the prologue of John's Gospel. It's a very, very rich prologue. And 9-12 talks about how the light comes into the world, but because of its lowly form, the world does not recognize it. There's a deep irony here that the creator of the world becomes part of that creation and nobody really notices. So Luke 14:10 is a parable where Jesus says, "Hey, when you're invited to a big dinner, fancy dinner, don't take the seat at the head of the table. Take the seat at the bottom of the table." Right? And then Matthew 18:3 is Jesus talking to the disciples, saying, "Unless you become like this child, this humble, lowly child, you will never enter the kingdom of God." Matthew 3:14. So this is the scene of Jesus' baptism, which for Catholics and Christians doesn't make a lot of sense. Because baptism is, you know, the sacrament that brings you into the church, and the function of baptism is to forgive sin. So theological doctrine of Christianity is Christ is like humans in all things, but did not sin. So why is he getting baptized? And actually, I do have a quote here from Augustine. He's more eloquent than I am. Get my glasses. So in the gospel passage, it talks about John stops and says, "Why am I baptizing you? You should baptize me." And Jesus returns and says, "This is to fulfill all justice." And Augustine says, "What is all justice? It was in the form of humility that Jesus was urging justice upon us. The heavenly Master and true Lord was urging justice upon us above all in the form of humility. That he was baptized, you see, was a matter of humility, and that's why, as he was about to do what was a matter of humility, he said, 'Let all justice be fulfilled.'" So that scene in the baptism, from Augustine's perspective, is purely an example of humility from his perspective, which I think is fair. I also think it's a leadership issue. Is that all Christians must be baptized, and so Christ provided the example to his followers that they ought to be baptized, and that's why he subjected himself to baptism. And I think Augustine is right. It is an act of humility, too. So Mark 10:42. I forget what that is. 10:42. So, and I think Mark 10:42. Oh, yeah, so this is the leadership world. So, and it's interesting, it's a lot of, I didn't do all the synoptic references, but almost all of these scriptural quotes are from one gospel, but they repeat in all the other gospels too. And so Mark 10:42 is the line where the disciples are fighting about who's going to be the greatest. And Jesus turns to them and says, you know, the greatest must, you know, you don't lord it over them like the Gentiles do. The greatest must be the most humble. Right? If you're going to lead, you need to be humble yourself and sacrifice yourself for others. That's what leaders do. Matthew 21:1-11 is... So this is really interesting. It's Jesus' triumph entry into Jerusalem. So, and this harkens back to the prophet Zechariah, where he talks about how the Messiah will come to Jerusalem on a donkey. And so, that is the way the triumphant Messiah comes in to Jerusalem, riding on an ass. So it's this picture of exaltation and humility all jammed together, and it really seems, at least from a worldly perspective, kind of crazily humble. It's ridiculous almost. So, and then you have the passion narratives, the humiliation of the cross. So it's, I think you can make a very strong scriptural argument that Jesus exhibits humility, and that he fosters it and thinks it's very important. Okay? So if he does all that for humility, turn around, but I got it right here. Is he magnanimous? So let's go to that. We already did. So wow. That's a lot of work. So I added some of the parallels. So Luke 4:16 is the beginning of Jesus' public ministry in Luke's gospel. And he says, he reads Isaiah's scroll, and Isaiah's talking about the coming of the Messiah, and he puts it down and he says, this prophecy is fulfilled in your midst. Right? Okay, so he's saying, when highlighting these scripture notes, I would say he has a pretty exalted view of himself, which I think as Christians, when we focus on humility, we kind of miss this. So Matthew 7:24. So this is from the Sermon on the Mount, and Luke's parallels the Sermon on the Plain. And so he talks about, he that builds his life on my teaching builds on rock. And if you're not building your life on your teaching, you're building on sand. So he has a pretty high view of his words. It gets even higher later on in Matthew 24. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. So Luke and Matthew 11:29-32, he's talking about the fact that many people don't recognize his exaltation when he's talking to them. He says, in reference to himself, there's something greater here than Solomon. There's something greater here than Jonah. And for the cities that don't recognize this, woe unto them, so to speak. Seems to have a high view of himself. He corrects the teaching of Moses and the law with regard to marriage and divorce. That's obviously very controversial to the Pharisees. He claims that he's Lord of the Sabbath, and it's very interesting. So, Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. Scholars debate, what does that actually mean? What does Son of Man mean? What does Lord of the Sabbath mean? His adversaries, they didn't really debate it. You know, his enemies were basically like, he's equating himself with God. We should kill him. That's what, you know, the Gospel of John articulates. And if you move into the Gospel of John, it gets even more exalted. John 10:9, I'm the gate to eternal life. You must enter through me to be saved. 11:25-26, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me will never die. I am the, John 14:6, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one can come to the Father except through me. John 8:58-18:5 are the I am sayings. And so these, again, scholars argue about what Jesus and John the Evangelist is actually trying to say with these. But I think it's a fair interpretation to say is that he's harking back to Isaiah and God, and also not just Isaiah, but even the book of Exodus, where God identifies himself as I am who am. And so he says in these various passages, simply in reference to himself, I am. And again, something that enrages his adversaries. They recognize what he's saying. Jesus has not only an exalted view of himself, an extraordinarily old exalted view of himself. And I think that's part of why people follow him. He's humble and he's magnanimous. So we do the last. So I'm sorry for this long quote, but I love it. So I'm going to make you guys suffer through it with me, but I'll read it from my paper. So I think this kind of goes to, it's really counterintuitive. It's from St. Augustine, one of his homilies, and it goes to the power of humility and leadership. And again, I want to give a priority to humility, that if all you're thinking about is your strengths, you're missing something really important, and you're likely to become proud or arrogant. And so Augustine talks about you know, the effect of Jesus on the Roman Empire. He says, our Lord Jesus Christ came not only for the salvation of the poor, but also the rich, not only the commoners, but also kings. He refused all the same to choose kings for his disciples, refused rich people, refused the nobly born, refused the learned, but instead he chose poor, uneducated, low-born fishermen, in whom his grace would shine through more clearly. He came, you see, to give the potion of humility and to cure pride. Again, that's one of his fundamental insights. And if he had first called a king, the king would have said that it was his rank that was chosen. And if he had first called a learned man, he would have said it was his teaching that was chosen. Those who were being called to lowliness and humility would have to be called by lowly and humble people. And so it is that Christ did not gain a fisherman through an emperor, but an emperor through a fisherman. And so, I mean, I would say that's well said. And so I do want to end on this. So, you know, this is the map of the world religions 2,000 years later. And so one of the things that I've done recently is written a small booklet, which is free, so not hawking merchandise. It's on the Knights of Columbus website about leadership insights that we can gain from the Gospels. And, you know, like a lot of Christian leadership scholarship is focused on servant leadership, which is great, very appropriate. But I think one problem with that is that it kind of obscures all the other insights that are in the Gospel stories about leadership. And so there are treasure troves of leadership. This is just one aspect that you can see in the Gospels, and there are a lot more. But what's really fascinating is that Jesus doesn't have the resume of the curriculum vitae of a leader. You know, he was born in poverty, had no formal education, he associated with the lowly, he was kind of a drifter, a dreamer. You know, he gets in trouble with the authorities of the day. They see him as a subversive. They convict him and, you know, kill him in the most humiliating fashion possible. That's not the resume of a typical leader, you know? Not a lot of people are going to follow that, right? But this is his leadership legacy. So this is the map of the world religions. Two-thirds of the world, you know, consider themselves followers of him. So how does that happen? It's an incomprehensible legacy of leadership. And so it's important, well, you know, as believers, we say, well, he's the Son of God, and the whole resurrection thing, that's pretty powerful. Get followers, and I think that's true, but we shouldn't limit ourselves there. There is so much in the Gospels to talk about leadership, and I think, you know, from a historical perspective, and it's really fascinating. It's like, if you Google on the internet, and I know everything on the internet is true, but if you Google on the internet, you know, great leaders in history, you know who's not on the list? Jesus. Well, before I get to that, you know who's on every list?
Alexander the Great.
Well, yeah, he is. He is. But another guy that might not be so great. What's that?
Hitler.
Yeah, he's on all the lists. He's a great leader. I don't know how we define great. But Jesus actually, he did make one list. He was number 39. And the list updates, you know, so like 3 years ago he was number 39. Now he's like number 21, I think, last time I checked. So moving up on the list. He was behind Robert Kennedy was number 38, and he was 39. There was a guy named Arminius. He was number 31. Has anybody heard of Arminius? The only reason I knew is I saw on this list, and then I looked him up. He was like a German warlord during the Roman Empire. You know, Arminius is his Latinized name or whatever. So he was number 31. So Jesus moved up to number 21, so he's going in the right direction. So, but you know, so we don't normally think of him in terms of leadership, but. You know, and obviously I'm a believer, and, you know, faith is the context in which I think about things, but I think you can make, from a historical argument, you can make the argument that he's the most influential leader, period. And so it'd be interesting to you know, reflect on what he did in order to achieve this.
Sir? Just out of curiosity, yeah. Is St. Paul on that list?
No.
Really?
Yeah. Well, you know, I shouldn't say it. You know, the lists are... And to be honest,
a lot of times St. Paul comes ahead of Christ.
Yeah, so a lot of people, and a lot of theologians who say St. Paul's more influential than Christ in Christianity, and he might be on some of the lists. It's been a little while. What you see is the lists are very Western centric, and they're very focused on the last century too. So you know, right. I mean, to say that like Robert Kennedy, you know, whether you're Democrat or Republican, I don't know, but to say that he's like one of the greatest leaders is kind of. Really a narrow view. Yeah. So, but thank you so much for coming. I really appreciate you listening, and I'll turn it over to you.
minutes for question and answer.
Yeah.
This ties into your lecture, but it was sparked after hearing the lecture by the fact that you began by the remembrance that this is 9/11.
Yeah.
So I want to refer to the airplane that crashed in Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania. And I want to ask you, what do you think sparked that rebellion? What kind of leadership did that entail to spark that rebellion on that plane?
Well, I hesitate to answer the question because it's not something I've read about recently. You know, at the time I read about it, so hopefully this will be somewhat tied to actual events. But I guess, you know, it's an interesting thing because I think in the end it comes down to love. That love, in its essence, you know, we can talk about love in different ways. We can talk about love as desire. So the Greeks have two words for this, eros and agape. And eros is the Greek word, agape is the Greek Christian word. So you see agape in the New Testament, you don't see it in Greek philosophical writings for the most part. But eros is the love of desire. But the love of desire is incomplete. And that we, you know, if all we have is the love of desire, we get whatever the object is we desire, and then we engulf it, so to speak. That's okay if it's pizza. But if it's, you know, say a husband or a wife, that doesn't work. So we have to transition into agape, which is self-sacrificial love. And so I think that, to me, that is one of the underlying motivations, the most powerful motivation for leadership, really, is when a leader demonstrates the ability to sacrifice themselves for the good of, say, a mission or for the good of the people that are part of his or her organization. That's when he pulls in loyalty and the passion of this people in a very powerful way. So whether that actually happened all in that little quick period of time in that small airplane, I don't know. But I think what they recognize, one is this is not going in a good direction. It's somebody is going to have to sacrifice themselves for the good of others. So I think that's, you know, that there's a link to leadership there, because I think in some senses that's the most powerful motivation a leader has in his or her schools. I think it operates at a lower level too, if that's fair. But I'm sure that was operative there. I mean, because that's how you get, it's like how you get, you know, the courage to do something like that, to throw yourself on your game to save, you know, your comrades in arms. And that is an act of love. And love in that sense, you know, reaches its height in service to others. I don't know if that is it.
A wonderful answer. Thank you.
Any one quick question? Just one quick one.
Yeah. Would you give your comments on the question of sort of whether leadership can be taught or whether leadership is sort of inborn?
Yeah. I'm in a department that teaches leadership, so I hope it can be taught. I tell my students in my philosophy class, if someone says either or, the answer is always both and. And I think, you know, it's kind of glib and superficial, but I think it's true, is that, you know, there are some people who want to lead, they've got they're extroverts, they've got the verbal skills to lead, all those things that you know, you're just kind of born with or desire, you know, that's really helpful to leadership. But I think it's also to say that if you don't have that, you can't lead. I think that's, one, is really false, and two, is very superficial. Is that in my view, and so I take a classical approach to morality, and I look at virtue and habits. Is that the reality is you can create habits, you know, and become a very good leader that people will trust. If you're a good moral person, if you're a person of integrity, and you practice morally excellent habits, you might not be the most articulate person in the world. Moses wasn't he needed Aaron to speak for him, but he was the leader. So you can become a leader. It's great if you're an extrovert and, you know, if you're good looking and all that kind of stuff. It's a good foundation. But what's interesting too, and I think this is true, it's interesting. So my oldest son just graduated from college, and he was always really bright, and he didn't have to work hard in school. And the upshot with that is he got good grades through high school, and he really struggled in college because he had to work, and he wasn't used to that. My second oldest was not as bright. I mean, he's bright, but he didn't come to him like my oldest, and he had to work. He had to work. He's in college now, and he's really kind of on his thing. So one of the things that's kind of paradoxical is you might have these great natural traits that kind of lend towards leadership, but if you don't have those and you have to work at them, you might actually outstrip the natural leader, so to speak, because really it is a function of work. Is that to be a good leader, to practice these skill sets and these good habits, it's really a function of practice. So I think it's both, but I think it's primarily practicing becoming a leader. Okay, thanks.
Thank you so much.